Hi, this is Icon Art Radio, and it's Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and me, Bill Teeple, and we're broadcasting from Icon Gallery on the Square in Fairfield. Donna has a topic, and she would not tell us what it was because she wants it to emerge spontaneously from our bosoms.
It was too complicated to try and explain it before we started recording, because it was some thoughts that kind of came up in the last few weeks while I was watching the politicians giving their speeches in this primary campaign. And I, after watching the regular news channels pretty regularly, I started watching C-SPAN because they would have entire speeches in various parts, places around the country that normally are not broadcast, or you just get little sound bites. And so I would listen to the same politicians giving their speeches over and over again, and I noticed that they would even repeat whole sentences and, you know, key phrases, and even tell the same jokes over and over again, because these particular speeches they knew were, you know, being given to a new audience all the time. But I, in watching them over and over again, would kind of get bugged, like, oh, here he comes, he's going to say that joke again. And sure enough, it was the same joke. And so I was thinking it'd be more exciting if they said something new each time. And all of a sudden, one day, it occurred to me that I do exactly the same thing in responding to questions, especially from people who I haven't seen in a while, and I'll run into them in town, and they will say, what have you been doing these days? And I will suddenly kick into the Donna Stump speech, basically, just rattling off, you know, what I've been saying for the last year or so that I've been doing. And then sometimes even after those conversations, I'll think, you know, I'm really not, haven't been doing that lately. I'm doing something completely different, or I'm wanting to do something completely different. And yet, even having that recognition, the next time somebody comes up to me, I'll revert back to that same little riff again. So that's sort of the topic. I want to talk about why we do that and what it is that could be done in our own lives as artists and just people living and growing to give more honest answers and be more kind of in the moment when we're asked questions about our lives.
That's a really good point.
This is really what we do.
Yeah.
This is what humans do.
Well, you know, for one thing, people so often just say, what do you do? And what they mean is, what's your job?
Mm-hmm.
And that somehow we or they expect that defines who we are. I find when people say, you know, what have you been up to lately? Mm. I draw a complete blank. I have no idea. I haven't been up to anything lately.
But you don't have your little spiel that you
I don't have a little spiel. I have to hunt around and remember something that I said to someone once. Otherwise, I'm inclined to just sort of pick up where my current thinking is, and they're not interested in that, because it's such a level of detail that you'd have to do 10 minutes or more of background.
But it's like the politicians. They want you to give them the spiel they want to hear, so you give it to them.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I traveled with, I spent, you know, the time that John Hagelin was in Long Beach with the Natural Law Party at that ill-fated convention. And I had gone down there to, you know, write, to be a policy consultant, basically, and help write the platform. And the experience turned into something completely different. But I found myself, you know, watching lots of tapes of John and watching John respond to people and schmoozing with people. And people on the street would come up and ask him questions, and reporters would ask him questions. And what his answer was very nearly a recitation. And, you know, at first I thought, oh boy, here we go, you know, the usual canned stuff. You know, what does he really think about these things? And then, you know, in very short order, I realized that, well, what else are you going to do? There's only so many answers to that question, and you're going to get the same question 1,000 times. You're going to end up, you know, saying something that gets more and more refined and polished and condensed and concise and, you know, to the point, and then you'll just blurt that out in a blob every time anyone asks that question.
Well, and for politicians, they really, the public really wants them to consolidate their platform in ways that they can get a grip on it and be able to understand
it. Yeah, they don't
want
to lecture.
So, you know, that's understandable. But in terms of us as ordinary people living our lives, what do you think people actually want to know? When they ask that question, what have you been doing these days? Do you think it's just kind of a polite thing that you say to people? Or do you think that
Some people are saying, how are you? And they expect something like, fine, not something like, well, my sinuses have been bothering me a little lately, and I had a sore throat a couple of weeks ago, but I think it's gone, and I don't know if this is sciatica or if I just pulled a muscle in my hip. I mean, who wants to hear that?
So, that's one thing, the greeting, and then there's the obligatory fine, I'm good, or as the Irish would say, grand, you know, even if they're dying. Yeah. In my own case, as far as moving through the day and speaking with people, it's a much more dicey business, and I have to watch myself, and it's a fine line that you walk between saying the thing that there's a knee-jerk reaction when somebody asks, when a certain subject comes up, and I start to say what I always say about that. Like, this is what I say about that. And I'm watching myself say what I say about that. The first time I said it, and it's usually in cycles, I'll say a certain thing about something for a while, a month or a year or something, and I usually, after a while, I shift and I have a new kind of like spiel that the very first time I say that, it's usually right on the money and responding directly to a new insight about it. Mm-hmm. But then I watch myself liking that insight and then using it again. And then I find that falls into a kind of a pattern of this is what I say about that. And then you sort of catch yourself after a while and you're sort of sick of hearing yourself say that about that. And it is no longer a spontaneous cognition. It's your recitation on that subject. And then at that moment, usually I get real. I get into the moment and I'm capable at that point of having a clear, direct cognition on the matter, and I start the cycle over again. So it seems to be a cyclic thing of human nature, and the way and I think it fits the whole steps of evolution, because I think we look as humans, and if we don't do this, we go nuts. If we don't find safety zones and safety platforms and niches to stand on before we take the next step, we sort of go insane. So you have to like find a safety niche, and then you have to break that down and make it to take another step. So you have to undo it, start again, take another step, and then you find a safety niche. And in many cases, a whole lifetime is a kind of safety niche. But I think this thing you're bringing up has to do with the whole cycle of the progress of evolution.
Yeah, that's really good. That was a great description of what happens. And I think that a lot of it is just integration. When you have, like you said, you have an insight, a new insight, you have to put it into action and live it on many levels for a while. And possibly while you're doing that, the only way that you can describe it to other people is in the words of that first insight, because the little gradations and integrations and subtleties that are coming along, they're just too hard to put into words. And maybe after some time, you've learned like some really solid new thing about that. And so there may be a middle stage in what you just described where you're bringing out kind of the conclusion of that phase, and then you have like the new one that comes along. Lately, this winter, it seems like a good winter thing to do. I feel like my own creativity is in a sort of hibernation. And rather than trying to produce something new, I'm reflecting on where I am, you know, asking these questions to myself. What am I doing these days? What am I thinking these days? And trying to give myself a more direct and honest answer. And it's been very interesting. It's kind of what made me think about this whole thing at all and notice this whole thing at all, because every day pretty much I give myself a new answer. And yet it's just tuning in to the subtle steps of what you just described, the little safety zones and all of the features of that.
There's two things too. It's like the artist being creative in his studio. We go through these steps quietly in our own development and in our process of manifestation of material things that capture this process. And I think it's very important that we try to be as truthful and as pulling the rug out from under everything as possible in that studio. But when you bring your work out and you put it in a gallery, or you go on stage and you perform, or you sing a song, or you create this thing, then you're interacting with the public, and it's definitely a performance. And in the arts, we know that standing on the stage reciting what we've learned and what we've put into a package and presented is a performance. But we also don't notice so much in everyday life that it's also a performance. Mm-hmm. That when everyone asks what you're doing or they bring up a subject, the curtain goes up and we start to perform, and we package that performance subtly without really realizing what we're doing, but it's a performance. And the most successful people in life really are the people that are really good at packaging their performance. Yeah.
Like the photographers who will photograph a big mess, a pile of junk, you know, wrinkled clothes or something like that, and it's a stunning photograph, because we talked about this in an earlier show, because the photographer has framed all of that complex, unsightly thing and given it dignity and beauty. And maybe that's what we want to do with our lives, is take something about this whole complex thing that's always changing and always moving and frame it in a way that makes it coherent to others and gives it some kind of beauty.
It's interesting. My response to that question is very different. there are two possible responses for me. One is, when someone asks, you know, what are you up to, or what have you been doing lately, or something. I mean, there's three, I guess. The one is a superficial one, where I may have just recently been helping someone carry wood. So I'll tell them I was just helping a friend of mine carry wood all afternoon. But that's not really what they were asking. And the second response is that I take the question completely literally. And I think, yes, someday maybe I will know. And I have nothing further to say. It's like, someday I hope to know what I'm doing. And then the third response is, it's the same as when someone says, you know, what are you thinking? As soon as someone says, what are you thinking? I look inside to see what he is thinking. He is not thinking. He is looking inside. And so the answer is nothing. And that's not what people want to hear either. So I never have a decent answer for it unless I actually, to be polite, you know, do some work. So for me, it's not really a fun question. It's like, oh God, the things I've been doing over the last couple of months, and which ones are most dominant right now, and which ones are most likely to be of interest to this person a little bit, and how can I summarize that in, you know, one polite sentence that doesn't sound like I'm dismissing the question.
Well, I was thinking that you are using that particular question as an example of the way that we fall into these patterns of response in every situation. You mentioned the politicians, and I have actually had the same experience that you've had. The first time I heard Obama give that speech, or someone, I felt that it was really happening in the moment. So I was a little disappointed in a way to hear it. I mean, it's all, I do the same thing myself in teaching. I do exactly the same thing. I'd fall into this like pattern of like, that question is asked or that problem arises, and then I say my thing that I say. But I feel that there's a little bit of a problem for these politicians in that they're pinpointing this package of words that they've put together for an audience in a particular moment, you know, in the state of Virginia or something, for this Virginia audience, and they're saying mostly the same stuff, but they're kind of skewing it to that audience.
Right, exactly.
And so that's one thing in that hall. But then when the national audience is watching all these speeches, it's another thing. And that's actually a problem for the politicians, because I think that when they're giving the speech, they're mostly thinking, I'm in a hall talking to Virginians, and they're not thinking so much that there's a whole national audience that's watching every speech they give. And that, some of the spontaneous power that comes across in the words it gets lost, and you feel like, and you know that when you go to a performance, like Richard Kind probably said the same thing 10 times to each audience, and each audience sort of probably felt this was his spontaneous improvisation tonight for us, you know. And we all kind of know that's probably not true, but we also like the thought that that's the one time. And if it leaks out too much that it's sort of being done over and over again and you're not special, then that's sort of disappointing.
Yeah, however, on the other hand, I think, and in relating all of this to our own lives, when people ask that question, what have you been doing these days? I think largely they pretty much are asking, what's your position in life?
Oh, yeah.
Right now,
sure.
You know, they actually sort of want to know your personal political platform so they can see if they relate to it.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't know if this applies in all circumstances, but I was on a retreat one time many years ago and went for about almost 4 weeks without speaking or writing. And what I heard people saying during lunch began to change. At the first few days, they were having interesting conversations about things that I would have been inclined to participate in, but I didn't because I had decided to be in silence. And then after a week or so, I began to hear what they were saying in a different way. And after 2 or 3 weeks, all I heard them saying was, "Hello, I'm here. Are you here? We are here. You're here with me. I'm here with you. Aren't we here? Yes, we're all here." And that's really all they were saying.
So the children's readers, the Dick and Jane books, are actually accurate.
Yeah.
They've condensed all of life into the essentials.
Yeah, I mean, talking about the sports or the weather or the politics or, you know, the program that you're all participating in or whatever it is, mostly it's affirmation and confirmation stuff that's just sort of bouncing around. And it's a way of dwelling on, like holding the attention on a sort of feeling of belonging and partnership and sharing and just sort of being alive and being human and being noticed and recognized. And there didn't seem to be, after 3 weeks, there didn't seem to be any content at all in what people were saying. It was all just, their hearts were using the mind and voice to bounce the stuff around, but the content was of no interest to them.
That's interesting, because I actually had a very traumatic experience one time, because I was having a conversation in a foreign country with the person I was traveling with, who I'd been talking to every day, and an American that we ran into that I had just met for the first time, and was excited to meet a new person, an American who had been living in that culture for 10 years, you know. So my desire in that conversation was to ask her a million questions about what's it like, you know, and to learn things. My traveling companion was interested in having that experience that you just described, because, you know, it had just been like the two of us for all this, and he wanted to have this kind of schmoozy connecting as Americans of the same generation, and she also wanted that. And so the two of them were going back and forth, basically saying nothing other than, I like this band too, you know, and oh yes, I remember this thing that happened in the 60s too. And it was just kind of this heart experience of conversation, and I kept butting in to that by asking specific questions to learn something. And they both would kind of like give me this funny look, like, what are you doing? It kind of didn't, I was taking it off of that level and sort of spoiling the mood of it. And I just got into a worse and worse mood, feeling like, why are they excluding me? And get, you know. So, and afterwards, when the whole thing was over and I was having a discussion with this person I was traveling with, he basically explained that same thing that you just said, that what people normally want in social conversation is this feel-good thing where they're all connecting, sometimes in a very superficial way, but it just, it's on the level of the heart, not on the level of knowledge. And for me, many times I've approached a conversation from the level of a student, mm-hmm. when everybody else is playing that other game, mm-hmm. and it's been a tricky thing for me.
Well, and I find that this this packaging, mm-hmm. of my insights and my knowledge and what I want to get across to people is completely couched in the needs that you're describing. Mm-hmm. That I've talked in the past about my teaching style and stuff. It's all about this thing of that we're affirming our brotherhood, sisterhood in this thing called life, and that we want to, you know, and we're moving forward together, and isn't that, you know, if I have a question to ask, or if I have a bit of knowledge I want to bring forth, I bring it forth very gently, taking into an account that what people really want is to acknowledge their existence
that's
together.
Right.
And that's about it.
Yeah.
And
really
we're here we-ing together, and it's, isn't it, I mean, and that's about it.
Yeah. Well, and another thing, Alan, when you were telling that story before about when you were in silence and you were listening to other people having conversations, another thing I thought of is when we're having a conversation where we're not silent and we're participating in it, half the time we don't really listen entirely to what other people are saying, because as soon as they trigger us, we're thinking about what we're going to say next. And those thoughts are dominating, and so we're not fully listening to them. So I was thinking, in that situation when you were silent, that probably your listening skills were also more attuned, not just to the feeling level, but even to the specific things that, you know, this person has this angle and that person has that angle, and I imagine that
would
probably also be true.
In school, very early on, I think most of us are taught that you get the most points for saying something smart.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a tragedy, because what it, I mean, it's good in that it exercises kids' minds and it makes them try to be alert and try to find whatever it is that teacher is talking about, you know, figure out what he actually is talking about. But it also teaches us to, you know, look for something we can respond to in what's going on around us, and then take that and, as you say, you know, figure out what you're going to say next, and then hang on to that and ignore everything that happens from then on until you get your foot in the door and you can say what you had planned to say. Mm. And I've noticed, you know, countless times, especially in things like business meetings and things where you really do have something that could be very important to, and then the time is gone. It's no longer relevant. Nobody's thinking about that anymore. And you finally get a chance to say it, and you say it, and everybody looks at you like you're an idiot. You know, why are you bringing that up again? And if it had come out at the time you had the thought, maybe you would have been the first to say something that way in that conversation. Or, you know, would have at least had a chance to contribute, which shows that, of course, what we're still really after is more on the feeling level than the content level.
Well, and there's, I mean, just what you brought up, too, shows that there are actually a couple of things going on. There is the feeling level and the connections that we want on the heart level, but there's also this kind of competition. Mm-hmm. That was a very interesting insight, I thought, about what we're taught in school. You get the points because you say something smart. And so that is a different motivator in conversation, where we want to connect with everybody else, but we also kind of want to be the smartest one, or at least be impressive.
Yeah. One thing we should mention before the show is over, and it almost is that the iconart.org website, icon-art.org, is now hosting an archive of all 61 of our previous radio broadcasts. And so if you go to www.icon-art.org, you'll see a picture of our three smiling faces and the words Icon Art Radio. And if you click on that, you'll get a list of all the programs, and you can simply click on a program to listen to it immediately, or right-click on it and download it to listen to it.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.